divested of this character only after reproduction. It is also known that the earliest infantile memories retain the character of perceptible vividness until late in life, even in persons who are otherwise not visual in memory. If, now, we keep in mind what part is played in the dream thoughts by the infantile reminiscences, or the fantasies based upon them, how often fragments of these reminiscences emerge in the dream content, and how often they even give origin to dream wishes, we cannot deny the probability that in the dream, too, the transformation of thoughts into visual images may be the result of the attraction exerted by the visually represented reminiscences striving for reanimation upon the thoughts severed from consciousness and struggling for expression. Following this conception, we may further describe the dream as a modified substitute for the infantile scene produced by transference to recent material. The infantile cannot enforce its renewal, and must therefore be satisfied to return as a dream. This reference to the significance of the infantile scenes, or of their fantastic repetitions, as in a manner furnishing the pattern for the dream content, renders superfluous the assumption made by Scherner and his pupils of an inner source of excitement. Scherner assumes a state of visual excitation of internal excitement in the organ of sight when the dreams manifest a particular vividness or a special abundance of visual elements. We need not object to this assumption, but may be satisfied with establishing such state of excitation for the psychic perceptive system of the organs of vision only. We shall, however, assert that this state of excitation is formed through the memory and is merely a refreshing of the former actual visual excitation. I cannot, from my own experience, give a good example showing such an influence of infantile reminiscence. My own dreams are surely less rich in perceptible elements than I must fancy those of others. But in my most beautiful and most vivid dream of late years, I can easily trace the hallucinatory distinctness of the dream contents to the sensuous nature of recently received impressions. On page 368, I mentioned a dream in which the dark blue colour of the water, the brown colour of the smoke issuing from the ship's funnels, and the sombre brown and red of the buildings which I had seen made a profound and lasting impression on my mind. This dream, if any, must be attributed to visual excitation. But what has brought my visual organ into this excitable state? It was a recent impression uniting itself with a series of former ones. The colours I beheld were those of the toy blocks with which my children erected a grand structure for my admiration on the day preceding the dream. The same sombre red colour covered the large blocks, and the same blue and brown the small ones. Connected with these were the colour impression of my last journey in Italy, the charming blue of the Isonzo and the lagoon, the brown hue of the Alpine region. The beautiful colours seen in the dream were but a repetition of those seen in the memory. Let us review what we have learned about this peculiarity which the dream has of transforming its content of ideas into plastic images. We have neither explained this character of the dream work nor traced it to known laws of psychology, but we have singled it out as pointing to unknown connections and designated it by the name of the regredient character. Wherever this regression has occurred, we have regarded it as an effect of the resistance which opposes the progress of the thought on its normal way to consciousness, as well as a result of the simultaneous attraction exerted upon it by the vivid memories present. Regression is perhaps facilitated in the dream by the cessation of the progressive stream running from the sense organs during the day. For this auxiliary moment, there must be compensation in the other forms of regression through a fortifying of the other motives of regression. We must also bear in mind that in pathological cases of regression, as in the dream, the process of transference of energy must be different from that of the regressions of normal psychic life, as it renders possible a full hallucinatory occupation of the perception systems. What we have described in the analysis of the dream work as regard for dramatic fitness may be referred to the selective attraction of visually recollected scenes touched by the dream thoughts. It is quite possible that this first part of our psychological utilization of the dream does not entirely satisfy even us. We must, however, console ourselves with the fact that we are compelled to build in the dark. If we have not altogether strayed from the right path, we shall be sure to reach about the same ground from another starting point, and thereafter perhaps be better able to see our way. C. The wish fulfillment. The dream of the burning child cited above affords us a welcome opportunity for appreciating the difficulties confronting the theory of wish fulfillment. That the dream should be nothing but a wish fulfillment surely seemed strange to us all. and that not alone because of the contradictions offered by the anxiety dream. After learning from the first analytical explanations that the dream conceals sense and psychic validity, we could hardly expect so simple a determination of this sense. According to the correct but concise definition of Aristotle, the dream is a continuation of thinking in sleep, insofar as one sleeps. Considering that during the day our thoughts produce such a diversity of psychic acts, judgments, conclusions, contradictions, expectations, intentions, etc., why should our sleeping thoughts be forced to confine themselves to the production of wishes? Are there not, on the contrary, many dreams that present a different psychic act in dream form, e.g. a solicitude, and is not the very transparent father's dream mentioned above of just such a nature? From the gleam of light falling into his eyes while asleep, the father draws the solicitous conclusion that a candle has been upset and may have set fire to the corpse. He transforms this conclusion into a dream by investing it with a senseful situation enacted in the present tense. What part is played in this dream by the wish fulfillment, and which are we to suspect, the predominance of the thought continued from the waking state, or of the thought incited by the new sensory impression? All these considerations are just, and force us to enter more deeply into the part played by the wish fulfillment in the dream, and into the significance of the waking thoughts continued in sleep. It is in fact the wish fulfillment that has already induced us to separate dreams into two groups. We have found some dreams that were plainly wish fulfillments, and others in which wish fulfillment could not be recognized, and was frequently concealed by every available means. In this latter class of dreams we recognized the influence of the dream censor. The undisguised wish dreams were chiefly found in children, yet fleeting, open-hearted wish dreams seemed, I purposely emphasize this word, to occur also in adults. We may now ask whence the wish fulfilled in the dream originates. But to what opposition or to what diversity do we refer this whence? I think it is to the opposition between conscious daily life and a psychic activity remaining unconscious which can only make itself noticeable during the night. I thus find a threefold possibility for the origin of a wish. Firstly, it may have been incited during the day, and owing to external circumstances failed to find gratification. There is thus left for the night an acknowledged but unfulfilled wish. Secondly, it may come to the surface during the day but be rejected, leaving an unfulfilled but suppressed wish. Or thirdly, it may have no relation to daily life and belong to those wishes that originate during the night from the suppression. If we now follow our scheme of the psychic apparatus, we can localize a wish of the first order in the system fork. We may assume that a wish of the second order